Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, down to Monterey, Faraday.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumbo Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumbo Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumbo Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you so much, Audrey. We could not do it without you. And ladies and gentlemen, we were talking here with Emily. Well, everyone was speaking with Emily, and Emily wants to sing Johnny Cash's song some night. She thinks that she knows the names of all 90 cities and states that Johnny Cash sings in that song. So, Emily, I think your night is coming up, and America is waiting, or at least four or five people are. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumbo Justice Radio Show. I'm your host, Keith Haley, and we want to thank Johnny again for taking us on that trip across 90 cities and states in the United States. You know, it might be fun, Mike. I was thinking, why don't we map out, do a Google map of all the different cities and states that Johnny Cash goes to and see what that looks like. That might be an interesting piece of original artwork. Emily and Audrey, Mike, thank you very much for joining us tonight. And we're off and running again. The purpose of the show is to discuss news, events, issues, and recent developments in the always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. We have an unusual one tonight. We're going to have Peter Lawfer back. He was here last week talking to us about, of all things, the butterflies. And tonight he's going to be talking about Forbidden Creatures, a book that he has written. The subtitle is Inside the World of Animal Smuggling and Exotic Pets. And he's right off the bat has got some very interesting stories. You can't believe some of these stories about exotic pets, but don't let me get started on that too soon. Our show is dedicated to those energetic and tireless police, courts, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals who protect us here in the United States, and they do that overseas too, as I'm sure you know if you're a listener. We look inside the criminal justice field, and we look close up at criminal justice practice, and tonight will be an example of an odd field that somebody's involved in investigating these crimes of smuggling animals, because it's illegal. Smuggling means it's illegal, I think. You're listening on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Get your own show if you haven't done it. That means that you, your organization, your college, your department, your church, whatever, any person, interest group, they can have their own show broadcast live and streaming audio across the Internet worldwide to an unlimited number of listeners, and it's absolutely free. And as I've said before, if you browse around the site, you'll even see President Obama has been on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Our shows are archived immediately for replay. We know that some people around the country actually do that, and some use them for class, that type of thing. I wonder what kind of editing they do, Mike. Some of these are my friends, but I wonder what they edit out. They certainly wouldn't edit out Audrey's blonde jokes, would they? I don't think so. I hope not. So anyway, get your own show. If you don't have one, you can do it. Tonight, I told you we're going to be looking at the world of exotic animals and animal smuggling, kind of an interesting subject for sure. You're listening on your computer or your cell phone, which you can do. And if you want to call in during the news segment of the show, we're not going to spend a lot of time on news tonight, but there's some big stories. Of course, one of the biggest ones is our Guantanamo Bay terrorist defendant was acquitted on all charges except one, charged with more than 280 offenses. And our successful, quote-unquote, prosecutor was successful in convicting him, getting him convicted on one charge. Interesting. A lot to that story. Well, Audrey has a blonde joke for us tonight, and ladies and gentlemen, should you happen to be a first-time listener, Audrey England, the woman that gets us on this show and does so much relative to technical expertise and publicity for our show, and her voice is known around the education community. She does blonde jokes. She is a blonde. She grew up in London, England, and she has thousands of them. Audrey, you have one tonight. Let's go ahead and hear it. Go ahead.
Professor Haley, tonight's blonde joke is another one about a blonde lady doing some painting. I hope that our listeners will like it. Here it is. A blonde decides to give back to society. She finally decides to paint an old man's home for free. So, what do I paint? She asks the old man. The porch. He laughs like there's an inside joke. Okay, she says excitedly. The old man walks in his house, and his wife looks upset at him. Did you tell her the porch goes all around the house? She asks. The man shook his head. Hey, the blonde calls. In a half hour, I'm done, and I even had paint left over, so I put on a second coat. She explains. The happy man waves as the blonde leaves. And by the way, the blonde says, that's not a Porsche, that's a Ferrari.
She painted his car twice. All right, good. ladies and gentlemen, in the interest of preventing and the reduction of crime, we are going to play the Ohio Coalition Against Firearms. Yes, they're against firearms, and the firearms that they're against, I think, are the ones that are in the hands of criminals, and we play that every week in interest of the street thugs and criminals will hear this message and take their guns down to the police department and turn them in and change their ways and turn away from their life of crime. Ohio Coalition, go ahead.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
It certainly is, Ohio Coalition, and we thank you very much for that public service announcement, and we hope it falls on the correct ears. Ladies and gentlemen, this is one tonight that is so obvious, our green tip. We always do a green tip, and we've been taking one week after week, not every week, but almost every week, from Esma Floyd's little book called 1001 Little Ways to Save the Planet. Small changes to create a greener, eco-friendly world. And this one is so obvious. You know, we're in a water bottle world, right? We have people that carry water around and four or five bottles of water. And we have people that carry jugs of water. We have people that carry their jugs and refill them continuously and drink water all day. I think you have to make some extra stops because of that. But anyway, here's one. It's really important to recycle your plastic bottle. Now, that is obvious, isn't it? But the reason for that is that you can, in fact, turn those bottles into all sorts of kinds of things, insulating fabrics, etc., and even clothing. And I'm going to do a little tip because you can buy Covington men's suits, men's slacks, and men's ties, and they're sold by Sears, and they are from all recyclable material. Yes, you do stand a little taller when you wear the Covington suit. excuse me, I don't mean to laugh. But anyway, that's our green tip for tonight. Take those bottles and make sure that they get recycled. All right, let's do some criminal justice news tonight. And where should we start? I think I could go on all evening about this verdict yesterday and the terrorist case. And let me give you a few little facts about this. But this is our first Guantanamo Bay terrorist subject. And it was the choice of the new presidential administration, President Obama and Eric Holder, and military people, I think, had to agree. Their view was that we should, in fact, try these people in civilian courts. And this trial took place. It went on for a while. And this young gentleman was charged with, as soon as it comes up here for me, come on, everybody. Oh, there it is. Yeah, this Al-Qaeda suspect, Gilani, was charged with 280-plus charges, if you can believe that. And he was convicted. The one he was convicted on carries a mandatory 20-year-to-life sentence. Don't ever count on that being 20 years, and certainly not life. But he was acquitted on 280 charges. He was convicted on the charge of conspiracy to damage a building, to blow up a building. He was acquitted on all the charges of conspiracy to kill the people in the building. So I guess the assumption here is the only thing the prosecutor was able to prove that Gilani was interested in what? Destroying the carpet in the building, knocking down the walls, burning up the furniture inside. But the bombing, you know, of course, killed more than 280 people. So he was acquitted on those charges. And the president administration, they stood tall on this. They said, we're going to provide these people the opportunity to face the American justice system, the best in the world, and I don't doubt that. But anyway, he went to trial. The trial was over. This bombing took place in the U.S. Embassy in Kenya, in Tanzania. It killed 224 people, excuse me, including 12 Americans. But yet he was convicted of conspiracy to blow up the building, but we couldn't make it on the killing people. Now, that's a little bit odd to me. There was a witness that was could have been usable in this trial, but his name came out of Gilani's enhanced interrogation. In other words, he was in a CIA black zone somewhere being interrogated, and the judge threw out or dismissed the opportunity for this person to testify. And they say this might have been critical testimony. Of course, the argument is what? Do we do these through military tribunals, which many, many people in America wanted and had been done before, or do we do this through the civilian trials and give them all the constitutional rights that they deserve? Now, keep in mind, this crime didn't occur in the United States. We are engaged in the term war on terror. I love that. Well, not really, but the war on terror. And the crime committed, you know, way over somewhere. So if we're in a war, it seems like somebody ought to be tried in a military tribunal. It seems like that. But anyway, I think what's happening, and we're already seeing repercussions on this, is that some are saying that this may be the last one, because the president's going to take a lot of heat on this, and many are saying, I told you so. And what's happening is maybe they're saying that they will do what that former president, George Bush, did. And George Bush said, what? Let's just let them stay in Guantanamo indefinitely and don't bring them up on any type of charge. I'm not saying I'm for that, but that may be the option if we get confused about what to do. And I think this one, would you be proud as a prosecutor to walk away from this trial where you lost on 280-plus charges? I mean, what kind of case did you have? if you have a good case, you can prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he did these 280 other things. Why in the world would you feel proud if you lost on all of them but one? Anyway, they're saying this is a victory because, you know, we got him on 20 to life. And, of course, don't believe that. 20, he'll be home in 6, probably. He'll be a nice guy, sweep up the prison yard and things like that. But anyway, I thought that was odd. Here's one that is kind of strange. The FBI seeks a wider wiretap law for the web.
Robert Mueller, director of the FBI, he went to Silicon Valley on Tuesday to meet with the top executives of several tech firms. And the people he met with were the top execs of Google and Facebook. Wait a minute, is that the same Google whose street camera accidentally picks up the email messages and passwords of people's computers as it goes down the street photographing houses and buildings? Is it that same Google? I think it is. And, of course, that mistake is a mistake, quote unquote, has been made in seven different countries at least. So, you know, Spain, England, I mean, go on and on. Canada, United States, Google made a mistake with that. Facebook, kind of an odd thing. A lot of people participate in Facebook, couldn't be more successful. But Mr. Mueller is asking them what they can do to make it easier for the FBI to get inside of their Facebook and their Google stuff. And is this the same Google who's one of the 19 agencies, private agencies, that contracts with the CIA? Remember that? We found that out in the Top Secret America series that Dana Priest did that's on the web, topsecretamerica.com. Could that be the same Google? But anyway, they want to expand the 1994 law, the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act, to impose regulation on Internet companies, too, not just phone companies like Verizon and Comcast. The FBI, they could ask Google also how to set up a case management system, because I think the FBI is working on, their third or fourth attempt to get a computer case management system, but kind of interesting, isn't it? They're talking to Google on how to do this. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I know this is totally unrelated, but yesterday, November 17th, who knows, at our desk here tonight, who knows what Google just did? Emily knows, I know, she loves clothes. Google just opened up the largest fashion boutique in the world online. And if you go to boutiques.com, you'll find a fashion shopping site, very well laid out site, all kinds of clothes whatsoever. And boutiques.com is expected to go up Wednesday morning, and it did. And people will go there. It may change how people shop for clothes. That's what Google's hoping. The Google engineers have a hard time qualifying it, but they got this thing set up, and away they go. So designers, retailers, bloggers, celebrities, regular folks, they're all going to be part of this boutiques.com, which is a Google site. Now, I know I'm over the line on this, but you have read, everybody at our table tonight in our studio has read it. They've all read the book by Catherine Albrecht called Spy Chicks. And Catherine Albrecht, one of the things that she found out in preparing that book is that there were some clothing manufacturers. One of them was Benetton, a women's clothing manufacturer. They put spy chips in people's clothes. Oh, I'm going crazy, aren't I? Google wouldn't be wanting to spy chip people's clothes, and then we'd be able to follow wealthy people who may live on the borderline of the law. I don't know, but it's a stretch. Well, Google wouldn't be interested in anything like that. Keep in mind, those email messages that were stolen, the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of email messages that were stolen by the Google Street Cam, it was an accident. They were sorry. But the accident persisted over like seven different countries. So you never know what your camera's going to pick up when you're not looking at that. Ladies and gentlemen, I don't have time to go into the whole business about the airport screening. You know, if you go through the, you don't want to go through the radiation scanner, and you can opt out, they scream opt out. You've seen all this all week, and people are still talking about it. In fact, I think it breaks the record on the Drudge Report website in terms of articles in a series and a line. I've never seen so many articles about this, but people are really mad about this. And I heard Glenn Beck say this on the radio 2 days ago. It was kind of funny. He was traveling somewhere, and they took him aside, and he was with his family members, and they took him aside, and they talked with him for quite a long time, and, you know, they took him through, the scanners and all that business, and when they're done talking to him, they finally put him back on the plane. But he gets on the plane, and they take off, and pretty soon it's time to eat. And so he orders a steak dinner, and the steak comes with a nice, long, sharp metal steak knife. So we check everybody to make sure they don't have any weapons like knives, and then you can order to take dinner and get your own knife when you're on the plane. Something is a little messed up there, but we're going to be hearing a lot more about this. And I've seen videos now. I saw one the other day of a small child, 3 or 4 year old young girl, being handled in the most grotesque way, embarrassing way, I would say. And people aren't going to put up with this. This isn't the answer. And you've seen adults doing that. The pictures that aren't supposed to be saved from the body scanners are showing up on the internet all over the place. So TSA's got something. Mr. Pistole, the former FBI agent who's in charge of the TSA now, the director of TSA, he says, you know, that we're just doing this to help make our travel safe. And he did say that there aren't going to be any exclusions for religions. And then I've heard other people say that there are going to be that. So airport screening is up. And you know they're making a lot of money, the people that manufacture these body scanners. I mean, they're making a lot of money. Don't quote me, but I think it's like $400,000 a device. And multiply that, maybe it's 1.4 million. I can't remember. Don't pay attention to that. Look it up. It takes seconds to find it on the internet. But this is something that people are really angry about, and the pilots are one of them. I mean, pilots say we go through this 3 or 4 times a week, you know, or more than that perhaps, and now they're tired of it. I mean, who knows what the effects of this radiation. Right now we say it's okay, but, you know, we used to say eggs were good for you, and eggs were bad, and eggs were good. And I did read a little story about there used to be a scanner that was invented in 1929, a radiation scanner that would properly size your foot. And it would make a perfect match for fitting shoes. And then they found out in 1944 or something like that that was cool. So who knows? But I don't like the idea of going through body scanners. There's a whole bunch of people that probably aren't going to fly this coming Thanksgiving weekend, supposedly the biggest travel day I've heard. And some are saying they want to boycott the day before Thanksgiving in terms of travel. So it's an interesting idea. Some strange things going on relative to all of that that business. I love this story about, did I do this last week? No, I didn't. This story about Russia's having juries now, jury trials, but judges don't like the jurors. And so when they figure out that a jury's going to kind of sway with the side of the defendant, they just dismiss them and get another jury. A lot of prosecutors are like that. See, I think they're going to rule against me, so let's get another jury. Let's impanel juries until we find one that gets us a conviction. That's kind of like Putin used to say, you know, you show me the man and I'll show you the crime, almost. So I'm not sure jury trials are going to go over real big in Russia, and they don't. In most places in the world, they don't use jury trials. You're convicted under the auspices of a judge. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's it for the news segment tonight. Let's jump ahead and go right on and hear Peter Lawfer. He was good last week as he talked about butterflies. I think you're going to find and hear some new things as he talks about the smuggling of animals and exotic pets. And some of these pets are really exotic. One of the stories he starts off with heard earlier is about a woman that paid big-time money for a monkey and smuggled it into the United States through the airports. As she posed as a pregnant woman, and the monkey was, in fact, the baby. Okay, let's go ahead and listen to Peter Lawfer and his book about forbidden creatures. It's about smuggling animals and exotic pets. It's working. Hold on. we're using Google Chrome browser, so they may be checking us out a little bit, having heard their name mentioned earlier.
Next, Peter Lawford looks at the network of hunters, traders, and customers who constitute the nefarious business.
This bookstore, there's absolutely no question about it. I was here, and I don't know, Chuck, was it 2 or 3 years ago now? I was here for a book called Mission Rejected, and this book was much more along the lines of the kinds of books that I have been doing throughout my career, dealing with relatively difficult social and political circumstances, and Mission Rejected dealt specifically...
I'm going to move him ahead just a little bit here.
...came back from the Iraq War, opposed to the war, or decided... But I said, this has all been really difficult, important work, I think, but difficult, and so my next book is going to be about butterflies and flowers. And there was a little in a new genre because of being here, this natural history world, and I thought of Smuggling Beyond Butterflies, and this book, Forbidden Creatures, came out of that. The world of smuggling animals, endangered species, and animals that are illegal to traffic in, is very similar to the world of gun smuggling and drug smuggling, not just because the same kinds of international activities take place, but also in terms of the money. After guns and drugs, Interpol estimates that illegal trade in animals is number 3 in dollars, to the tune of some estimated to $20 billion a year, which is an incredible amount of money. And so that was intriguing to me. But as I continued to investigate this world of forbidden creatures and smuggling, I found myself much more interested in the question that John Stewart asked, which was, who are these people? Who is it that wants to have an animal that's illegal to have, and who is it that wants to have an animal that's even legal to have? Because there are places in this country where it's completely legal to have a tiger or a lion or a chimpanzee or a monkey or a 24-foot-long, 200-pound python, not boa constrictor, python. And so who is it that wants this stuff? Why do they want it? What are they doing with it? And that became what it was that I looked into in this book. Now, the idea of exotic pets or exotic animals being held by individuals goes back way, way back. Marco Polo writes of the Kublai Khan having a tiger or a lion by his side. And William Randolph Hearst in San Simeon down in California had a zoo that he finally got rid of as the Depression hit, and even he had to watch his funds. And his zoo became the San Francisco Zoo. It became the Flyshacker Zoo and what is now the San Francisco Zoo. This idea of keeping an animal that is either rare or dangerous or both, and then with the added value for some of being illegal, is something that seems to connect with people who want to exhibit their power and see the animals as an extension of their egos. It's often somebody who has an engagement in an illegal activity. A lot of drug smugglers seem to have their own private zoos. Politicians or people who have political power, business men and women who have vast amounts of money and are looking for what to do with it, but those aren't the only types. And right here in Washington, I started my research with a woman I found north of Spokane, and just south of the Canadian border, who had been convicted, along with her daughter, of smuggling a monkey into the United States from Thailand. It was an extraordinary story, and she opened up her home and told me about it, even while her case was on appeal. It's intriguing, the reality of human nature, and for a journalist seeking the interview, it's always amazing how most people do want to talk, and I often give the advice, don't talk to me. Don't talk to a journalist. They're probably not going to get the story right, unless they're really good, and even if they get it right, you're not going to like the way it's written or broadcast, and yet most of us, if we're asked to talk about ourselves, we'll talk, and this woman talked, and I'm glad she did, because it helped round out the story. Let me tell you that story. She and her daughter went to Thailand because her daughter wanted a pet monkey. And this is not necessarily something that would have been illegal at the time for her to have. And there is, for example, I cite it here in the book, Forbidden Creatures, there is an outfit in Louisiana that will sell you a monkey. And if you come up with $5,000 or $10,000, and depending on the laws in your state and the laws of shipment and the laws in your local jurisdiction, it might well be legal for you to have a monkey. And yet they decided, apparently, although they still deny the charges, they are now guilty in federal court, so they are felons on appeal. They decided to go to Thailand and pick up a monkey, and they were able to get the monkey for about $10. How did they get the monkey back into this country? Because that certainly is illegal. And how did they get the monkey back into this country in the post 9/11 era of such extraordinary security? How did they get the monkey back into the country coming out of Bangkok and transferring in Seoul and in Hong Kong and coming into LAX, into Los Angeles International Airport, and then going from Los Angeles and getting up here to Washington, getting to Spokane with the monkey, which they did. They accomplished all of that. And the way they did that was by the daughter feigning pregnancy. And they drugged this monkey and put it under her clothing as if she were pregnant, and managed to make that trip and get home to Spokane, where the monkey and the daughter lived apparently happily ever after in an apartment on the north side of Spokane. Until she was wandering around the local shopping center with the monkey and bragging about how they had got it into this country, despite the fact that what they did would have been illegal. And consequently, somebody picked up the telephone, called Fish and Wildlife Service, and they were arrested, tried, and found guilty. Now, three events have occurred in the last little while that have raised our awareness of these exotic pets and the potential dangers that they can cause to our communities, the potential problems that can exist for the animals, and just the question of what should we be doing? What should we be doing with animals? What's appropriate to do with animals? These three events that you probably are aware of, or at least aware of a couple of them, Zigfried and Roy, the Las Vegas act with the tigers, one of those guys, and I always forget which, I think it's Roy, was maimed and almost lost his life by one of his tigers that he had reared from a baby. Bottle fed this cat, and it knew him well, and it was used to being in acts in Las Vegas. They claim that it was spooked by the microphone or a chain or something that made it try to release what was bothering it, and he ended up in the way. But nonetheless, he almost lost his life, and it was very high profile. And then there was Travis the chimpanzee. And most of you, I'm sure, are aware of that story. And that's the chimpanzee in Stamford, Connecticut, that was living almost all of its life with a woman in the suburbs, essentially, and was famous, the two of them were famous for sleeping together, drinking wine from stemmed glassware together. The chimpanzee, Travis, appeared in several commercials and was known in the community. And he was having some kind of a problem. She was having some kind of a problem with him. She called a friend of hers to help her. And when that friend arrived, the chimpanzee attacked the friend and literally tore the face off the friend and otherwise mutilated her. Miraculously, she survived. Interestingly enough, in the intervening time, the chimpanzee, I'll tell you how he died if you don't know, but the owner of the chimpanzee died, and that's not an issue any longer, except in the lawsuits that continue with her heirs, because the woman who was named is trying to get some kind of monetary return to, I suppose, help pay for the extraordinary bills that she has, because certainly no amount of money could compensate for what happened to her. The chimpanzee, after he tore at this woman, ran amok. The police were there by that time. He knew his way around human stuff. His drawings were pinned up on the refrigerator wall. He was dexterous, and he was working on opening up a squad car door, and a terrified policeman inside shot him. He ran out into the woods and then circled back into the house and into the cage, because he did have a cage where he lived in his room in the house. I just did this and realized I forgot to show you. Here's the butterfly pin that I have worn since just after that night here at Village Books, when The Dangerous World of Butterflies came out. And the chimpanzee then died in the cage, a bloody mess. So there's Siegfried and Roy, Travis the chimpanzee, and then a girl in Florida was smothered by the Burmese python that her mother's boyfriend had in their trailer just outside of Orlando. So those three things really raised the consciousness in the public of this question. What are these exotic pets in our midst, and should they be with us? Well, some of them are legal, as I said. Some are illegal, and often the fact that they are illegal happens after an incident. Laws were changed here in Washington after the smuggled monkey case, even though nothing egregious happened other than the two of them being found egregious for them. They were found guilty of felonies. But it's not all illegal. There are plenty of places where this stuff is completely legal. And Texas is a really good cocktail party example for just a quick fix of figures. All indications are, from organizations like Traffic, which is a non-governmental organization that works against international illegal trade in animals, and other similar organizations, all indications are that there are more tigers in Texas than there are tigers in India. More captive-bred tigers in Texas, illegal captive-bred tigers in Texas, than there are wild tigers in India, which brings up another aspect of this story that is delicate, that I deal with in the book, and that I think we all need to deal with, which is what this question of what's wild, what's tamed, what is feral, and what's domesticated. And then is there another category like Travis? Travis the chimpanzee was captive bred in Missouri, another state like Texas that still is pretty much wide open for this sort of thing. And so what is Travis, or what was Travis before he was shot by the policeman and died? He's certainly not a wild animal. He never was in Africa. What would happen to him if he were shipped over there and injected into a community of chimpanzees? He probably, I would think, wouldn't last. But what is he here? He's not a domesticated animal. He's not a tamed animal, as he proved. And would he go goat barrel. How would he have survived if that shot had been glancing and he ran off into the woods and nobody knew where he went? These are issues that are worth contemplating, I think, and I do in the book. In fact, looking at it from the standpoint of our own animals that are our pets. What are these pets, and how far are they from being wild? What about our domesticated animals, the sheep, the cows? How far are they from being wild, and what about us, ourselves? So there are these places where these animals are legal. Again, Texas is such a fantastic example. But think about people breeding, and not just in Texas. So Ohio and Indiana are two really good example states. What is this all about with people free to breed these animals and do with them what they wish, up to sometimes minimal constraints, just simple disturbance of the peace or not being cruel to them, as one can't be cruel to animals anyway. There are laws in place, but not necessarily laws that affect having as an animal living adjacent to you, that if it were to get loose, you might not like it. I went to Missouri and managed to conduct an interview with the woman who operates a place called Chimp Party, just south of St. Louis. And Chimp Party does a few things. Chimpanzees can be hired. Maybe your kid is having a birthday and it's been a little mundane the last few birthdays, and the neighbor kids are having more entertaining birthday parties, so you could hire a chimpanzee to come to the birthday party. And that brings to mind another issue that I deal with in the book. Maybe some of you remember J. Fred Muggs. J. Fred Muggs was on the Today Show back at the very beginning of the Today Show when it really lagged in the ratings and it wasn't clear whether or not it was going to be a successful television show. And the host was languishing until J. Fred Muggs, the chimpanzee, became essentially the co-host. And what did he do by accepting him into that role, anthropomorphizing him to the point where he dressed in business suits sometimes or a T-shirt other times and having birthday parties on the set of the Today Show? And that allows us to think about these animals in a way that maybe isn't appropriate for us and for the animals, and leads to things like Chimp Party, where you can hire a chimpanzee to go to your kid's birthday party. But that's not all that goes on there, or has gone on there. It also is a place where chimpanzees have been bred, and perhaps are still being bred. And Travis was bred there and sold to the woman in Connecticut. And so I had an opportunity to go there and speak with the woman, Connie Casey, who owns the place, and tour Chimp Party, where there were a relative enormous number of chimpanzees. She made I think this is the only ground rule she asked for, which I respect for the interview. She said, don't tell anybody how many chimpanzees I have here. She's got a lot of chimpanzees there. And I have two images. Well, first let me set the scene for you. It's south of St. Louis, and it's in a place that's suburban, rural. There's a lot of room between the houses, but it's not wide open spaces. And her house from the outside looks like a kind of a ranch house, except for the fact that in the yard there are these silo-like huge cages with different primates in them. She welcomed me up onto the porch. We talked for a while, and then we went into the house. And the living room, again, looks relatively like an all-American living room, except for the shrine that she has on the hearth of more than hundreds, had to be thousands of little monkey dolls and monkey images and chimpanzee images, little statues and figurines covering this whole wall of the house, along with a couple of urns that had, one had the ashes of her first chimpanzee and the other had the ashes of a chimpanzee that had escaped from her place and had been shot by a neighbor, which is another fascinating story that I tell in the book. The neighbor was on his own property, Jason Coates. Jason Coates was on his own property when this chimpanzee had escaped And he says he felt threatened. He was 17 years old at the time. And he went into his house and he got his gun and he shot the chimpanzee dead. He went to jail. The charges are, I think, quite astounding. The charges that he that put him in jail were destruction of private property, which is fascinating since this private property was, one, on his property, and two, was alive, and he says he felt threatened by it. This was a dozen years ago or so, but what brings it very much to today is once Travis ran amok and devastated the woman he attacked, Jason Coates appealed to the governor to have his conviction thrown out, and as of the writing of the book, that's still pending because he says that that proves that he acted appropriately and that, in fact, there was an issue involved and his life was threatened. So I was in the house there of Connie Casey, the breeder of chimpanzees in Festus, Missouri, south of St. Louis. And as we left the living room, and imagine this now, if you will. So you're in a typical suburban American house living room, and except for the two urns with the ashes of the chimpanzees and the thousand or so images of chimpanzees that are on the hearth, it just looks like a regular house. And around the bend where it would be maybe the corridor that would go down to the bedroom, what I was faced with was a glass wall and a drop into what must have been the basement at one time, so it was two stories. And in that enclosure were a couple of her chimpanzees, including Kimmy. And I want to tell you the story of Kimmy. She keeps these chimpanzees, some of them together so that they can hang out together, and some of them separated because they don't get along too well. And Kimmy came up to the glass, and she started to engage in frantic sign language, but sign language of her own making, so that it was unknown what she was doing. But looking into those eyes that, and again, of course, now I'm anthropomorphizing this chimpanzee, but they are awfully close to it, and we all have at some time or another engaged in some kind of interspecies interaction, petting the dog or scratching the cat, and we feel as if we know this animal on some level. And I'm looking into the eyes of this animal that's making these frantic gestures like this, and she looked so forlorn. Let me just read to you how that affected me and what that was like. Connie Casey knocks on the glass, and Kimmy, a tired-looking 42-year-old chimpanzee, stares up. She's gray, and her fur is spare with skin showing through it. A thin gray beard outlines her chin. She shares the accommodations with two other chimpanzees. Hey, Kimmy, says Connie Casey through the glass. Kimmy comes right up to the glass and begins making frantic-looking hand signals, a sign language Kimmy created, and no one else understands. What do you want? Asks Casey. Banana? Kimmy looks forlorn and continues to sign, her soulful eyes looking at us, imploring us to understand her message. Kimmy tells us again, it's impossible for me not to think she's asking to get out. Those big eyes stare at me, and I cannot help but feel that she knows she's stuck in there, as big an enclosure as it is, as well-equipped as it is, and I'm not. I look away from her eyes and her hands and notice she's toothless. Connie Casey tells me Kimmy is a retired zippy chimp and arrived in Festus with no teeth, not uncommon for show business chimps of her era. A toothless chimp is not able to cause biting injuries. Zippy the Chimp was a television star in the 1950s and 60s. There were Zippy dolls, Zippy comic books, maybe some of you remember. A troupe of different chimpanzees played Zippy, and Kimmy was one of them, according to Connie Casey, who talks at the glass again. What? Huh? Apple? What do you want? Kimmy keeps up an intricate series of fast-changing hand signs. Casey keeps asking her what she wants. I find the act extremely difficult to watch. Kimmy seems one sad and frustrated animal and looks remarkably like Connie and me. Similar hands, similar head, and similar sad eyes. I love you, sweetie pie, says Casey, and Kimmy taps on the glass. What? I'll get you something, says Casey. She adopts a sing-song voice. You already had breakfast. You want an apple? What? More? That's her sign for more, Casey tells me. Kimmy makes another gesture. That's her sign for please. It was an extraordinarily difficult interaction to watch, and she's behind this multi-pane laminated glass that keeps her on her side, because once these animals pass adolescence, even somebody who knows them intimately, like Connie Casey, who's bred them, cannot necessarily be safe with them. The chimpanzees that are body weight and our height have 4 to 7 times the muscle power, according to most calculations. So when they get frantic and attack, which happens, then they can do a lot of damage. Those teeth that were pulled, they have enormous, powerful, sharp canine teeth. And they go after soft tissue right away when they attack someone. And that's why it's often the hands, places on the face, the genitals. They mutilate people. Now, it's important to point out that if you look at statistics, within the exotic animal community, these big cats, long snakes, great apes, look at statistics from that the federal government keeps on reported attacks. They're really minuscule. Does that mean that it's okay to have them around? That's something for us to decide. If you compare them with dog bites and with deaths from dog bites, they're minuscule. But they get the headlines because what are we doing with these animals? And it's weird. It's strange, at least I find it so, and fascinating. Connie Casey and I went downstairs then in the house. And there was one chimpanzee who was taking water. It's this huge guy. I'm a pretty big guy. This guy dwarfed me. And or at least it felt that way to me. He's behind bars, but he doesn't have glass. And he's spewing water out of it. His mouth. And she says, oh, don't worry about that. He's just doing that because he knew. And it just missed me. And then we went around the corner to the other chimpanzee I want to tell you about, Connor. And Connor is another one of these big bruisers. Healthy, just post-adolescent, strong guy. And he's in a room that has 3 walls and then the glass in front. And he's walking around the room. He's pacing around the room like this. And he comes around to the 4th wall and he smashes it with his hand. And you can see his power. He does this with his hand and his forearm. And he does this as we're looking. One time, another time, again and again, and then he gets up on his trapeze, which is in the middle of the room, and he starts swinging on his trapeze, and he's swinging like this on his trapeze, and he jumps off and lands like this, face forward, with this incredible thud, right up against the glass. And, well let me read what I wrote at that point, because it was really nice that the glass held. In a room across from the spitting chimp, an ape is throwing bedding. At the next window is another of the massive animals, this one marching in circles around the room. I'm introduced to 14-year-old Connor. That's when the testosterone kicks in, says Connie about his age. Connor paces, circumnavigating his room, and as he comes around a far corner to face us, looking at him from the other side of the glass, he whacks his forearm against the room wall with a force that makes an ominous, loud bang. Over and over again, he makes his rounds. He stops and stares. He climbs on a rope swing and starts to pump, still facing us, swinging back and forth, then jumps off, smashing front first right up against the glass, facing us, all 200-some pounds of trapped chimpanzee muscle. with three panes of laminated tempered glass hold. I imagine, much to Connor's frustration, he looks as if he'd like to come out. And what? I'm not sure, but I'm glad the glass didn't break. He sits and sucks his thumb, and he looks at me. Confused and sad is how I interpret his intense stare. It was a remarkable experience there at Chimp Party. So I was here in Washington with the monkey smugglers there at Chimp Party and traveled around the country and outside of the country meeting these people and getting a sense of what, well, maybe getting a sense of what kind of people want these animals. Again and again, I go back to this this desire both to interact with and commune with another species combined with something that seems like a desire to dominate and control. And then the icing on the cake is having something no one else has. And that seems to be what drove the Burmese python trade in Florida, and particularly in South Florida. Burmese python came in as a pet over a generation ago. And these animals thrive in Southeast Asia, where they come from, but not much is known about them there. And they're quite gorgeous. You don't like snakes much. And this is the guy here on the cover of Forbidden Creatures, which is one of the Burmese pythons. And they eat. And they eat. And they can get from this relatively manageable size where a guy might want to walk down South Beach with one around his neck and use it for a so-called chick magnet to the point where they are 24 feet and 200 pounds. And that's a lot of snake to keep in captivity, just in terms of the amount of food that they need and the kind of mess that food makes after it goes through the system of the animal. Consequently, a lot of people caught these snakes, had them around their neck or whatever else they were doing with them, fed them, they got bigger, maybe they got the girlfriend and didn't need the snake anymore, or they just tired of the snake because it got too big and too unwieldy. And then all indications are that a lot of them were taken out into the Everglades and dumped. And maybe not maliciously. Maybe the owners thought, well, this is good for the snake. This is an inviting habitat. And it is an inviting habitat, very similar to where they came from, with lots of neat stuff to eat, and in fact, protected habitat if it's in the Everglades National Park. And so they have multiplied and multiplied and multiplied, and they easily multiply. And here's an example of why and how they easily multiply. An egg-laden female can be holding 50 to 60 eggs that are viable. And there's...
Well, I think you've heard enough to be able to go to booktv.org and look up Forbidden Creatures or Animal Smuggling. You could use that up in the search box at the top left of booktv.org and hear the rest of that book being presented by this author, Peter Laufer. Certainly an interesting subject, unusual one. Most people don't think much about, but as he said, that's a $20 billion a year smuggling business. So anyway, join us next week. And look on the show billing, see what we're going to do. We're going to have Vera Lynn take us off, as she usually does here at the end of the show.
We'll meet again. Don't know where. Don't know when. But I know we'll meet again. Some sunny day. Smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello the folks that I know, tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing. again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again. Some